Senator Yee.
I just want to say, when we talked about risk management last session, I invited Hua Chang's safety management expert to come in and have his input. And he said the most important thing Hua Chang did, they have a fantastic safety record. And every morning, the management meets with the foreman and all the workers every day to go over the safety features that they have to do every day. Manager, department head, foreman, workers. I ask him every day, he said, yes, the most important part is for everybody get together and go over the safety rules every day. That's why they have a very good safety record.
They are an excellent model. We've used them. Forestry, interestingly, has what they call tailgate meetings. When they're out in the woods, they get out of the crummy or whatever the vehicle, the state probably doesn't call them crummies. They get out of the thing, and at the tailgate, they get together and say, okay, we're about to go out here in the woods. What are we going to do to stay safe? And they talk about the risks and stuff like that.
They end up getting back in the crummy.
I want to make one more comment. I think it's time to compliment Dave White for doing a good job.
Yeah, thank you.
We're real proud of you.
I'm impressed.
It has really been, though, a very much comprehensive effort by all kinds of people. Could not have been done without all of the elements, I think. Well, we could have done some, but not as much. Mr. Chairman, I haven't hit asbestos yet, and I do have an asbestos report for you. Would you like me to?
I'd like you to go over it briefly, because I had a question relevant to the appropriation that was made in the last biennium for asbestos and where we are now in terms of the costs that are anticipated.
Essentially, Senate Bill 55 last session was passed in order to get the state to respond to asbestos risk on a uniform basis. There are people who believe asbestos is an overblown risk and people who believe it's much more dangerous than it's said. My testimony was that when the federal government and the courts say it's a health hazard, it is. It doesn't matter what anyone else thinks, because we could lose a lot. The issues were that if we do nothing, then we leave the decision in the hands of anybody else out there. They might close a prison on us, they might close an institution or facility because they're angry and they can show there's an asbestos problem and do it through a court injunction. The other issue was that if one agency is dealing with it, another agency shouldn't be ignoring it. So uniformity was the goal. What we've done, there was $1.3 million appropriated essentially to pay for a survey, an inspection of all of our buildings that needed it. We're looking at almost 30 million square feet. That survey won't be finished yet for a few months. But as they go along, they're finding about $1 million in very immediate problems for every million square feet they inspect. Probably 100 million or 150 million in ultimate cost. But they were talking over 50 or 100 years. Not anything to look at today. But the immediate hazards, asbestos currently in the work environment, about $1 million per million square feet. That's $25 to $35 million that we will find in this biennium that we need to do something about. $5 million of which has been funded through set asides that were in the emergency board and were paid out for projects to get those corrected. I'll skip beyond then some of the stuff that we're doing. One of the main things is setting up a database so we can still find all of this asbestos 50 years from now and prove that it was or was not a problem whenever we discovered it now. Also so that we can come to you and say, what's the state of the state's asbestos? What kind of costs are out there ahead of us? Which agencies are doing it, which aren't? Also so that we can say to an agency, don't spend $5 million on remodeling when you say you can't afford to do $1 million on urgent asbestos problems. And balance those issues out. We'll have that done, that survey in place, and all of the problems we hope found by the end of the biennium. We're also training hundreds of state workers on how to work with asbestos and writing uniform standards for bids and so forth in working in it, and uniform standards for how you work with it. But essentially it comes down to this. We'll, at the end of the biennium, find, let's say, $30 million in immediate problems. $5 million will have been funded, leaving $25 million unfunded, but needing to be done immediately. There is a proposal in the governor's recommended budget to put $15 million in the emergency board as a set-aside for deferred maintenance and asbestos. I think you could write asbestos on that $15 million if it is in there.
Is that part of the $50 million in the emergency fund?
It would.
I don't know whether it's part of the 50. Last year, it was not part of the 50. Generally, the 50 is for unidentified. I mean, when I say 50, it's not generally 50, but whatever amount is in there is for unforeseen emergencies. And then if you have something that's earmarked, it's in addition to that. Like this year, we had 50, but I think in total, we had like 200.
So assume that goes through, then we've got 10 million.
Or yeah, 10 perhaps. And so we're looking at COPs and saying some of these can effectively be funded that way, perhaps at higher ed, certainly at general services. The L&I building is an area that is an immediate need. And so there will be another 20 or 25 million in COP authority. But that doesn't answer the problem for some agencies. COPs are useless to them if they have no income stream or whatever. We would then propose that while with those two funding sources you could cover, in theory, the 25 million or so, we don't really know how each one of these projects will work out. So we would add a layer on this and say to each agency, you're going to need to justify to risk management, and we would testify to the emergency board, that you really don't have any alternative but to do the cleanup we're recommending before you ask for emergency board money. An example might be, you know, when the surveyor goes through and they find a problem in a wing in a building, it may be that under Measure 5, we're not going to use that wing. So it doesn't make sense to go then spend $500,000 cleaning it up now when we could clean it up in the future if we decide to use the wing. Now, our surveyors, an engineering firm, they can't know those kinds of things, so it'll be up to the agency to say that. In some cases, an agency with the new trained people that we have will say, now we think we can do a temporary cleanup job on this, and we'll do the ultimate repair work next biennium or when the smoke settles from Measure 5, if it ever does. And so we're going to ask the agencies, even though it looks like it's a tight fit, there may be money available to do all these things, we're going to ask them first to justify how they might avoid actually spending that money in the coming biennium. And we'll have to see how that works out, because from my office, with two folks on asbestos, we can't know 30 million square feet and what they plan to do with every piece of it. But we'll add that layer in. And we would anticipate all of this coming then in stages to the e-board, early stages, we hope. That's the other thing. If an agency says, I'm not going to do anything, we'll have to ask them to justify that too. We can't have them leave a hazard untouched after we've identified it.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Yee.
I think we, didn't we set aside $20 million for asbestos during this biennium? Did we spend it all?
We had $10 million, and part of that $10 million was the $1.3 that covered the survey, and we spent up to, I think we had left $2.6 million was remaining at the end of the interim.
So we spent about $7 million.
Yeah, agencies came in just about every e-board. They came, the agencies didn't come in, the executive department comes in with a unified request and said that during this period we've identified these critical areas. And this time with the $10 million, they focused only on those buildings that are operated 24 hours a day and what they considered to be, I forget what the terminology was we used, but really high use critical 24-hour service buildings.
Mental health institutions, corrections, where we have people that really couldn't, were exposed to it all the time. That was the highest risk, so we wanted to deal with them first.
And if I can just interject the comment about the COPs, I'm thinking on the November request for $2.262,000 for the State System of Higher Education. I don't remember all of the lists. I know that hard-hearted analysts did not recommend that, but the reason being that these are quite often buildings that are maintained and funded with a building fee, and there's a stream of revenue, and that perhaps that general fund shot could have gone someplace else. But Dave was talking about in terms of there might be some alternative sources of revenue, and by that I'm not advocating that it necessarily be COPs.
Well, but that raises an interesting question, though, too. Can higher ed issue a revenue bond?
Higher ed doesn't issue revenue bonds. They have general fund, general obligation bonding authority. They have a stream of revenue, but they are still general obligation bonds. They have both Article 11G, which are outright general obligation bonds that have a general fund payback, and Article 11F, which are general obligation bonds that operate kind of like revenue bonds, because there's, the payback is a stream of revenue.
And we'd like to see agencies, and we will urge them to work on their funding sources if they have it. So if higher ed was looking at a dorm where the M bonds might work, that might be a way to go. But it is clearly a tight fit. What we did say last session was we're going to awaken a sleeping tiger with this bill, and we better be ready to deal with him when he wakes up. And he woke up and Measure 5 passed. Mm-hmm. And that combination was not planned on.
Well, it's very interesting. The what would the COP is there? Can we use COPs for asbestos removal?
If there's a funding or an income stream, an example would be that take a higher ed facility. It's the easiest one. Well, they could take a single building, right, and say we'll provide the lease, the COP, certificate of participation, on this building, but the funding will go to repair all of our asbestos on campus.
Well, what about in general government?
The L&I building is part of our COP proposal for that reason. And there, the income stream is an internal one, certainly. But the trouble is, if you want to contrast it, take a corrections facility. Mm-hmm. General fund is the income stream.
Well, if we use COPs and came up with enough capital to do the majority of the work, the $20 million that we have, is that enough to set aside to pay the debt service on?
If I hear you right, are you saying could we do a central COP that would cover all the agencies? Possible.
I'm thinking out loud.
Well, the COP, for instance, if on this $2 million project, that was a lot of different projects, but let's assume that it was one building where there was a revenue stream. How the COPs are issued and when and in what blocks are really that's determined by the state treasurer, yeah, with the institution and with the Department of General Services. You might have a COP that's issued that includes a lot of different things, and that has a lot to do with getting in on the bond market and what the right time is and so forth. So
it would cross historic lines somewhat too, in the sense that higher ed clearly has responsibility for their facilities, but I still don't know. That's something to talk to Dan and the experts about. We really need to.
And right now, of course, the governor's budget does, you know, getting off into another agency, higher ed, but the governor's budget, yep, has no COP authority in it for any kind of building or
there is a
construction
bill, though, that would propose that. Yeah.
Well, it'd be interesting to have some discussion with the state treasurer to see if there might be some merit. $20 million set aside, whether or not there's enough debt service money that could come out of that. We're going to adjourn unless there's anything else that anybody wants to say. Dan?
I think Dave covered it well, but I just wanted to make sure that you heard it. There were a lot of numbers whizzing by. In the 91-93 biennium, we advise agencies to budget $96 million. About 2 months ago, as the governor's budget was being put together, we had some revised projections, and that came down to $44 million. The number that you saw in front of you, that $53 million or $52 million difference was captured in the governor's budget. The number that Dave was telling you today, between $25 and $30 million, will enable you to take that difference, mm-hmm, which about 40 million or 40% is general fund monies, and incorporate that into your planning, and we'll certify that over to you later. That's news to Dave.
Okay, so if we're talking $30 million instead of $44 million,
we're talking $25 or $30 million instead of $44 million.
Which gives us roughly $14 million, 40% of which is general fund money.
Yes.
And that's in addition to what we've already.
That's in addition, yeah, three numbers, 96 down to 44, and that's spent.
30.
The new numbers that he gave you today, the $14 million difference, and again, the caveat is that he just got the actuarial report, and they haven't had an opportunity to really go through that with a fine-tooth comb to give us all the comfort that we need. But it looks at, as we're sitting here today, that there's at least $14 million difference, of which 40% is general fund monies. And as I say, that's a significant number as you proceed with your budgetary planning.
Okay. I think there's one, if I could make just one point, too, that sometimes gets confused, and that we're talking about budgeting now, And many times agencies get confused, and analysts and Ways and Means members and everybody else, to differentiate between making the budget, which is the plan, and having the charge, which is the premium. And sometimes those are not exactly the same, because the budget is made every 2 years and the premiums are determined every year. And so it's just like when you're budgeting for anything else, you
February 7, 1991, General Government, Ways and Means Subcommittee.
We left off yesterday with Mr. Dave White. Are you going to come back up again and finish your presentation today?
Mr. Chairman, that is, answer any questions in the presentation if you like, or just move to 2045, as you wish.
Well, didn't you have something, some part of your presentation you needed?
We had moved through the asbestos issues. There is a request for a budget note on our plan of insurance, which I didn't review orally, but it's in the written testimony.
Okay. Have an independent package, I think, decision package?
Oh, decision packages, certainly. If you'd like, I can review those. The decision packages, Mr. Chairman, for the record, I am Dave White, Administrator Risk Management Division. The decision packages appear on page 8 in your 7 and 8 in your handouts. And decision package 172 is for staffing. We have had, we've kept track a lot with the increasing numbers of claims over the years by making changes in how we operate, doing more by telephone, et cetera. But it has reached the breaking point, and in part because of the change in the mix of claims over the years. For example, we raised deductibles, and that eliminated hundreds of little bitty claims that can be handled routinely, and yet our claim volume is still up, and that's because of the much more complex claims that tend to come against the government anymore. Those require a senior claims adjuster to deal with, and they require a lot more time and effort. The answer to not dealing with them well, of course, is essentially that we can't get on them quickly enough and resolve them, resulting in increased expense. Speed is oftentimes really important in claims processing, but you don't know exactly when that will be. If someone has been injured, we can be on the spot, resolve the claim, make a fair payment offer to them. Often it ends right there. If not, it'll move on into litigation. And litigation in state government adds a dollar of litigation cost for every dollar of claims cost.
Let me ask you a question about that, Dave. Is there a point at which you've identified the, not sure exactly what to call it, a line of demarcation or a point of diminishing return where it's the state's policy to say we are not going to pay this claim? We know it's going to pay, cost us more money to enter into litigation. However, it's such a frivolous claim, we're not going to honor it. We're not
absolutely
going to pay it.
In fact, that's one reason the state's litigation cost is higher than an insurance company. An insurance company will sometimes just pay people a nuisance amount to get lost. The state has to deal more with what is public policy, what is the law, what's the appropriate thing to do in this matter. Probably an example I could give you of an appeal as one example. The Dr. Brady case in Portland involves some new questions of law. In essence, the state courts had taken it to the point where they were saying a jury can essentially look at your action after the fact and decide whether you use good judgment or not. And that's as far as it went. So we met with the Appellate Division of Justice and decided we should fund an appeal to the Supreme Court, which of the nation, which we felt we would lose, but we thought would clearly establish this law, and therefore in the long run save the state a lot, because we know what we should do to avoid a similar type of case in the future. We did that. It cost us about $20,000, and the Supreme Court did deny it, and they didn't give us any guidance at all. So sometimes you lose, even when you lose. But definitely, there are cases where we have to spend sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars defending the state through the Department of Justice, because the state cannot afford to let the plaintiff whim. And that's seen, in fact, in one of the handouts I gave you that covered the last decade's losses. There's an analysis of litigation cost, and it just goes up dramatically. That has been climbing a couple of million dollars a year for a long time. But in that little graph there, we show how much of that is what we call new litigation. About 5 years ago, mandamus, declaratory actions, injunctive relief, these kinds of things were moved over to the insurance fund. And so what looks like a real increase in litigation cost is really a transfer. Those things were dealt with in the past just through the emergency board or through an agency's budget, and now are dealt with through the insurance fund. And if you take out those new kinds of claims that the insurance fund covers, actually litigation cost has been almost flat. And we were as surprised as anyone to find that. But those are the examples, those kinds of claims, where somebody's telling us to do something different than we're doing, where the state just has to go toe-to-toe with them and defend its actions all the way if, in fact, it believes those are important to its public policy or mission.
What percentage of the total number of claims are the complex claims versus the nuisance claims?
The percent in numbers is small. It's probably, in fact, I have exact numbers in one of the reports I gave you, but it's about an 80-20 rule. You get about 20% of the claims that are very complex. They amount for about 80% of our dollars. And so, again, that's why you have to give them the attention.
Who does the liaison work between your office and the Attorney General's office, or the screening of the cases for litigation?
The real day in and day out, the nitty-gritty stuff, is handled between our claims adjuster and the assigned attorney. So there are there's a kind of a one-on-one relationship there. Whenever it's what we would call a sensitive claim, high dollar cost, or would impact an agency's mission, or would interest the news media to a great extent, why we'll bring the agency in too, and we have a lot of three-way meetings, our adjuster, justice, and the agency person. If it is a issue that's going to move well beyond that arena, then it will be me and John McCulloch, the administrator over there. And sometimes those are fast moving. OHSU, for example, was and is a source of blood and blood clotting factor for hemophiliacs. And during the time that the AIDS situation was coming on, most of those blood centers were caught with the disease spreading faster than the technology and the knowledge. So probably our center infected an unknown number of people, perhaps a couple of dozen. One is in Alaska right now, and that's where the lawsuit is currently. Because it's brought in Alaska, our tort claim limits have no application. And we're looking at an exposure there of anywhere between $100,000 or millions on a single case, knowing there are many other cases behind it.
That's an interesting thing you just mentioned. Because it was brought in Alaska, our tort claims limits don't apply. And if it's brought in Alaska, what compels us to?
It was an Alaskan citizen in this case.
Uh-huh.
And so they're able to bring it in either state or in federal court.
So whose law is controlled? The federal courts?
Yeah. If you bring a state action in a federal court, and there are cases in which you can do that, then the courts will recognize our tort claims limit. But if you can cite any federal issue or interstate issue, you can escape from them. And virtually, it would be an exaggeration to say every case, but lots of cases cite some kind of civil rights issue in connection
with hope to get into the federal court.
Right. It's freedom of speech or something that they'll pull in a federal issue. And so we spend quite a bit of time trying to defeat those. Now, the real warriors in that case are our Department of Justice. We retain the right to settle cases, and that's kind of a good tension between us and the Department of Justice. If an attorney wants to just go in and slug it out, we could go in and settle the case out from under him. In fact, we have a good relationship. And I delegate to John McCulloch whatever settlement authority that we have established on a given case. In this one in Alaska, however, we're the federal judge up there has ordered us to appear and prepare to settle if necessary. And so our claims adjuster, or my claims manager, will go up there with John McCulloch so that we have both points of view on the case. So when we have a very, very complex and difficult case, we work as a team. in many other cases, will split off, and Department of Justice will predominate on the case and take care of it and just keep us posted occasionally. In a lot of cases, these move very, very slowly, and we don't have to have a lot of activity in them. You really can't, it's awfully hard to generalize. There are just too many. We do, for example, not duplicate each other's work, so Department of Justice has medical specialists, and they'll do the kind of work we do in most cases, the preliminary pretrial stuff, they will also do on Med-Mal cases. And there's no reason for both of us to have that expertise in-house.
The kind of interesting, the AIDS cases that were a result of actions at OHSU, were those pre-1985 cases?
Yes.
Prior to the screening of the blood through the various
right.
tests that are done?
And the arguments are essentially, you should have known, and it comes right down to, and these cases have happened enough in the nation now that it's pretty well established. When did the AMA or anyone else identify a certain protocol, and did we adopt it quickly enough? What if blood had been, this is an issue that arises in some of them, what if blood had been given out, or it's actually blood clotting factor, had been given out to hemophiliacs on, say, a month's supply, and then 4 days later we found that a different protocol should be used, did we call that back? Around the nation, most of them have been won by the blood center, but those that have lost have paid pretty heavily. The Alaskan case may not be, you know, a landmark for us because there are a lot of other factors there. That gentleman does not have any of the symptoms at this point, only the factor that shows that he's
HIV.
Been exposed. So those will be followed through. I think the key issue in risk management are not really what happens once those cases get into court. It is how we handle the cases that might not have gotten into court if we'd done the right thing at the right time. And those are, those take